My feelings are we've got a good system in place right now. It's a workable system that follows all of DOD processes and regulations.
General Katkus responds to allegations of misconduct in the Alaska National Guard. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, how the ballot initiatives could affect the outcome of Alaska's hotly contested U.S. Senate race.
The conditions are ripe for these ballot measures to potentially shape the races in 2014.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The National Transportation Safety Board is recommending a comprehensive audit of safety programs and regulatory compliance of the company providing much of the commuter air service within Alaska. The NTSB announced today it's recommending the urgent action by the Federal Aviation Administration for a review of Hoth Incorporated. That company includes Hagland Aviation, Frontier Flying Service, and Era Aviation doing business as Raven Alaska, Raven Connect, and Corvus Airlines. The NTSB says it has investigated six accidents and one incident related to the company since 2012. That includes fatal crashes November 29th near the St. Mary's Airport and on April 8th about 22 miles southeast of Kwikset. Governor Sean Parnell has been responding to allegations that sexual assault crimes within the state's National Guard were reported to him 4 years before he requested a federal investigation. The governor says as soon as he had specific information, he acted. Parnell's commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Major General Thomas Katkus, says the federal investigation should help improve the system.
I'm confident that the assessment will come in with a better way of doing it. This is the first time we've really stepped back and evaluated from top to bottom the entire process. And I would hope they'd be able to come in and advise us of better ways to do business. So we look forward to what we will get as feedback. My feelings are we've got a good system in place right now. It's a workable system that follows all of DOD processes and regulations. And I'm thinking an outside look like this is going to provide us that much more suggestions that we can incorporate and make this better.
Governor Parnell said he acted as to call for a national investigation as soon as he had specifics. What kind of specific information is needed to prompt an investigation?
For the National Guard Bureau, of which the governor asked, it's just a request of the governor. The governor, anytime that he has a desire to have an independent assessment or a look into an organization he's responsible with, which would be the Air Guard or the Army Guard, he can contact the National Guard Bureau, advise them of the problem, and they will propose the best solution set to step forward to look into it. He puts the problem statement forward, and they provide the resource that best answers that.
Why wouldn't chaplains risking their positions to bring the concerns forward to the governor be enough to prompt an investigation by DOD?
I don't know that I have an answer for that. The chaplains shouldn't be at risk bringing any of these issues forward. There's no risk to them. Matter of fact, it's incumbent upon them to bring those issues forward. The significant responsibility that they're held to is to advise the commander of issues of ethics, morals, and morale within an organization. So they're almost held on a no harm, no foul. They're required to bring the bad news forward if they've got the bad news.
Well, it seems as if there was some confusion or hesitancy in that regard. Your deputy commissioner, McHugh Pierre, asked the chaplains to sign a document saying they wouldn't speak on behalf of the Guard, when actually what they were doing was bringing victim concerns forward. Did you ask him to do those things, or was that something that he felt like he just needed to do as deputy commissioner?
I believe the letter you're referring to is an email that went out to all of our members as we were approaching the political season. And it was advising everyone to be very judicious and cautious on how they answer anyone that is approaching them and asking them for an official position of the department. So in that sense, that was just to reiterate to clear it with a supervisor, and we're not prohibiting anybody from talking to the press or their chain of command or other people, just that they try to clear that, get the best information possible, and if they're speaking for the department, make sure they've cleared it through our public affairs office.
Major General, how damaging is this for morale?
You know, it's damaging for morale. Where I'm very, very concerned, and this is really, we have made such great strides in making people aware that they have a process in place, what I just described, the DOD process in place, that they can get results. It's a very transparent process, and that they can feel comfortable reporting and that they're going to get the help. With all of the adverse press and the senior officials who have basically expressed their concern and trust, I would hope that does not translate at the other end of the food chain to the young members who may be victimized and may now decide not to come forward because of lack of trust in the system.
Major General Thomas Katkus is the State Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. When the Republican-led legislature went into overtime last week, they knocked a set of citizens' initiatives onto an already packed November ballot. In the process, they changed the playing field in a fight for a U.S. Senate seat that their party needs to pick up if they want to take control of Congress. But as APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports, the shift might not be in their favor.
Caroline Tolbert has studied politics for decades. A professor at the University of Iowa, she's written dozens of papers on elections, and she's given special attention to the role ballot measures play in them. Among the big takeaways,
ballot measures do have an effect in increasing turnout.
And people tend to factor those issues in when they're voting on candidates. If a measure is popular, voters are more likely to support a candidate who is seen as sympathetic to it. Alaska voters are looking at three initiatives this November. There's one to increase the minimum wage, one that would make it harder to build the proposed Pebble Mine, and another that would regulate marijuana like alcohol. There's also a citywide question in Anchorage that would repeal a controversial labor law. Tolbert says that when all three initiatives are combined, they could boost turnout by as much as 5%.
The conditions are ripe for these ballot measures to potentially increase turnout and potentially shape the races in 2014.
With the caveat that Alaska is uniquely difficult to survey, all three initiatives poll favorably. They're especially likely to attract support from younger and often more liberal voters. Tolbert says this could amount to an advantage for Democrats.
If there's going to be a spillover effect from minimum wage or legalization of marijuana or an environmental type ballot measure, it should, if anything, it would have a positive effect on the Democrats running for office.
And that advantage could be a special boon to Democratic incumbent Mark Begich, who is fighting off three Republican challengers in the U.S. Senate race. That race is one of the most closely watched in the country, and it's been listed as a toss-up by all the big political analysts. None of the Senate campaigns, including Begich's, would speak to how they see the initiatives affecting the race. But the initiative campaigns acknowledge their ballot measures could shake things up. Art Hackney is a consultant working on the Anti-Pebble Mine initiative.
It has the potential to, without a doubt. A lot of that has to do with the candidates as they go forward to the election. I mean, I said early on that if they moved them across to the general, it would certainly have a big benefit for Byron Mallott,
the Democratic candidate for governor,
and Mark Begich.
That's because those Democrats have come out against the development of Pebble Mine. Even though Hackney sees Democrats benefiting, he says initiatives like his should still cross political lines. He can see a person supporting the Anti-Pebble Initiative and voting for a Republican ticket. After all, he's a prime example of that. On top of his initiative work, Hackney has a portfolio of Republican clients.
We are involved in a super PAC trying to help Dan Sullivan beat Mark Begich. Will we do that heart and soul? Absolutely. If there is some level that Mark Begich will try to trade upon the Pebble issue, so be it.
Taylor Bickford is a spokesperson for the Marijuana Initiative, and he's kind of in the same camp. Like Hackney, he's mostly worked to get Republicans elected. He also thinks the ballot measure he represents has crossover appeal, especially to the state's more libertarian-leaning voters.
If you were looking at it objectively, I think it would be safe to say that having the Marijuana Initiative on the ballot will have some impact on turnout. It's just very, very hard to say how significant that'll be.
Of all the initiatives, the minimum wage measure seems to be the one that most obviously helps Democrats. Alaska AFL-CIO President Vince Beltrami has been a major backer of the effort. His union has put money into the initiative and helped gather signatures to get it on the ballot. He says his constituency will definitely be coming out to vote on it.
We're going to be very motivated, and our membership will be very motivated to turn out.
Beltrami points out that the Alaska Minimum Wage Initiative was in the works a year before National Democrats seized on it as a campaign strategy. And originally, all of the initiatives were scheduled to be on the primary ballot, alongside a referendum to repeal Governor Sean Parnell's law capping oil taxes. But he says it became apparent that the other party was afraid of it after a block of Republican state lawmakers tried and failed to pass their own minimum wage hike that would have taken the initiative off the ballot.
You'd have to be blind not to see the implications that it had on the election.
Now, the question is just how big those implications will be. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, photos from an early 1900s expedition in the Bering Strait region are now online.
Being able to access that history is hugely important.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Officials with Flint Hills Resources Alaska began shutting down the company's North Pole refinery today. KWAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Flint Hills took the refinery's extraction unit offline a minute past midnight this morning. That halts production of gasoline, but company spokesman Jeff Cook says the facility will continue to refine other petroleum products until later this month.
The balance of the refinery we expect to take offline and off production 3 weeks later on around the 24th of May.
Flint Hills officials announced their decision to shut down the refinery in February, citing high operating costs and expenses associated with cleaning up North Pole area groundwater tainted by sulfalane, an industrial solvent that leaked from the refinery for years. Company officials plan to keep only the facility's fuel terminal operating to sell petroleum products brought in from other refineries. The shutdowns are the beginning of the process of decommissioning the refinery, a process Cook likened to winterizing a facility that's going to be sitting idle for a while. He says that's being done in anticipation of the company eventually finding a buyer for the refinery.
We're doing it in such a way that if a buyer would come along in the next few months, that we'd be able to restart the refinery, or they would. So it's certainly not being torn down or anything.
Flint Hills and its parent company, Kansas-based multinational Koch Industries, have been trying for months to sell the refinery. Cook said Tuesday he can't talk about the status of those efforts. He says many of the workers in the 90 or so positions that'll be lost by the closure have taken the company up on its offer to give them jobs at other Flint Hills or Koch facilities. The refinery closure will cost the borough and North Pole millions of dollars in property tax revenues. Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says much more needs to be done immediately to both promote the sale of the refinery and to find solutions to the high price of North Slope royalty oil that the refinery is locked into using. as well as steep transportation and energy costs.
Is there an economic model that somebody would want to come in and operate that refinery with the current conditions that they have for royalty oil and for Quality Bank? I mean, these things are incredible stresses on in-state refining.
The mayor says it'll take the combined efforts of all players, especially local and state government, to come up with a solution, and soon. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Before statehood and the advent of scientific management, Southeast Alaska's herring populations were harvested and depleted. Many believe the herring population in Sitka Sound now is a fraction of what it was in those days and wonder if herring stocks, like salmon, can be restored. KCAW's Emily Foreman has the story.
Just look at Raven Radio's Facebook page. Photos of active herring spawning in Sitka Sound and hemlock branches coated with eggs are the kind of posts that go viral. It's clear that many more than the 9,000 people that live in Sitka are herring obsessed.
Culturally, it's important, obviously, as a major subsistence resource in the Sitka area, but also very important in trade.
That's Chuck Smythe.
I'm the director of the History and Culture Department at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
Smythe says there are places that used to attract herring that don't anymore.
You know, some of the oral histories suggest that herring just sort of stopped coming and moved to another area.
Smythe is working with the Sitka tribe to figure out why they stopped coming and how the population might be restored throughout Southeast. The Alaska Native Fund granted SHI $15,000 to develop a herring restoration plan in the Sitka vicinity. They chose Sitka because it still attracts heaps of herring.
Right now, Sitka has one of the larger herring stocks here in Southeast.
80,000 tons. Jeff Feldpouch is STA's Resource Protection Director.
So if you were looking at transferring eggs to other locations, Sitka would probably have the biomass available as far as herring eggs to be able to do that.
Figuring out exactly how to transplant herring eggs is the tricky part.
You know, I've been told stories about harvesters from other communities who would come over to Sitka and pick up eggs for their community, and on their way home, they would they'd place a few branches in the water in different locations.
Anecdotes like this one will be heavily weighted in the brainstorming process, but a recent study on Pacific herring will serve as the framework. Anthropologist Tom Thornton was the principal investigator for the Herring Synthesis Project. Smythe says it's the most thorough attempt to date at demystifying the Pacific herring. And so why now?
Well, it was just realizing that this significant study had been completed that I came to the realization that it would be good to use that information and try to take it to the next step.
The Herring Synthesis Project combines archaeological, biological, and cultural data. It identifies things like how herring were distributed throughout Southeast, what factors could have changed spawning location, and where herring could thrive, and basically concludes that there are a lot less herring than there used to be.
Probably, you know, before the late 1800s, before there were directed commercial fisheries on them.
Feldpouch says the goal is to return herring to historical levels. Back before commercial sacro fisheries, back before herring were mainly reduced to oil, and back before herring were simply fish for bait. Smythe says he is in the midst of working his way through Thornton's study.
And there's just a lot we don't know about herring.
Like why they left certain areas. There are a lot of factors to consider.
Possibly pollution from logging and pulp mills.
And other industrial activities that may have contaminated the water.
And also, you know, herring are kind of a significant food source for many animals.
Or hatchery salmon released when the herring are most vulnerable. The next step? STA will host a panel discussion of experts in June. Thornton's study will serve as the framework for the discussion, and Feldpouch hopes it will be specific.
One of the things we're going to try to identify is spawning environment that would be conducive to herring populations, and a lot of that will be using traditional knowledge and looking back at where herring used to spawn.
He says the project is a productive step and hopes the end product will be implemented throughout Southeast. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Foreman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
One of Southeast's longest-serving lawmakers is retiring. Peggy Wilson says she will not seek re-election to her Wrangell-based House district. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Peggy Wilson's stepping down for two reasons.
My mom hasn't been well, and I'm just worried about her so much, and because of session, I couldn't go.
And
since December, I've had four great-grandbabies being born, and there's another one on the way. I missed it with my grandchildren, and now my grandchildren are having children.
Wilson says her own health is fine, but at 68, the long days and late nights are taking their toll.
I don't want to be falling asleep in committees. And I need to let somebody younger do this.
Wilson's been in Alaska's House of Representatives for 14 years. She began as the Wrangell-Petersburg-Sitka rep. Then reapportionment dropped all but Wrangell and added Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island. She originally planned to run for re-election, and she expected it to be tough.
Ketchikan really is so used to having their own person that they really want somebody from Ketchikan. But they wanted somebody from Ketchikan last time, and I made it.
Wilson's first big issue was education, and she's continued to push for funding and other improvements.
It was my legislation that got the cost differential into place, and I feel real good about that.
But she's very concerned about the legislature and administration's recent directions. She says focusing on charter, church, and homeschools will hurt traditional public schools.
We do need to make changes in education, but we can't make them and leave people out. We've got to make the changes so that it can ultimately reach everyone and not just a select few.
One of Wilson's biggest disappointments was the failure of a roads and highways infrastructure fund. The retiring Wrangell lawmaker authored bills for the past 6 years. One measure made it through the House and to the Senate Finance Committee this session, but it remained there when the final gavel fell.
Are you going to try to get someone else to reintroduce this next time around, or is it this was the opportunity and it's lost?
No, I definitely am going to look for people that will continue on, because I firmly believe for the health of Alaska overall, our roads need fixing. We need to have more roads, and it's not going to happen with the current status quo.
At least two people are running for Wilson's House seat. The most recent to announce is Ketchikan Visitors Bureau CEO Patty Mackey, a Republican who ran 2 years ago. Another is Ketchikan teacher Dan Ortiz, who will run as an independent. Others are expected. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
In 1897, the American Museum of Natural History sent a team of anthropologists to the Pacific Northwest and Siberia. They brought back thousands of photographs, many of which are now available online for the first time. KSKA's Monica Goki has more.
More than 100 years ago, a team of adventurous anthropologists set out to compare the cultures of the Pacific Northwest and Siberia. Their 6-year trip was called the Jessup North Pacific Expedition. Barbara Mathey is a special collections manager at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. She says the theory that the Americas were populated by human migration across the Bering Land Bridge was not commonly accepted at the time.
It was the first and arguably one of the most important anthropological expeditions, not just in the history of the American Museum of Natural History, but in the history of the discipline of anthropology.
The anthropologists hope that documenting parallels between cultures on either side of the Bering Strait would prove their theory, and it did. In addition to photographs,
they collected stories, and the stories of the raven were found to be so similar in Siberia and on the northwest coast of North America that it just really seemed to be indisputable that this was so, they must have been in contact for a really long time.
Digitizing the American Museum's photo archive is in line with a broader trend in the museum world to make historical material available at the click of a mouse. The photos released on Monday, Mathey says, are only a fraction of the total collection.
There are close to 3,000 photographs from the Jesup North Pacific Expedition. We've got, I think, about 600 or 700 up right now, but we've got a lot of others that are in the pipeline. A lot of them have already been scanned.
The photos available right now are from the expedition's work in Siberia. Images documenting the culture of the Pacific Northwest, including Alaska, will be added soon. Digitizing the collection has been no small feat. Mathey says the pictures are stored on glass plates, literally pieces of glass, about 5x7 or 8x6.
We've got a small army of volunteers and interns who are being supervised by our staff, and we're getting these images out.
In addition to the Jesup photos, the museum has plans to digitize images from other early explorers to Alaska, like E.W. Nelson and George Emmons, who came before the Jesup expedition. For history curator Katie Ringsmith at the Anchorage Museum, having the Jesup photos online brings a piece of regional history closer to home.
They're just gorgeous photographs. I think that being able to access that history is hugely important. And being able to bring that history to people who may not get a chance to go to New York and visit the museum and see the collection firsthand, it's such an important role to provide that information to people.
Ringsmith says the Jesup expedition happened at a time when the U.S. was starting to get very interested in Alaska. Progressive-era politicians saw the region as a critical link between continents. Anthropologists saw a link that went back thousands of years.
And I think that underscores, in many ways, Alaska history itself, that we aren't the end of anything. We're not the end of the road. We're not the bridge to nowhere. In fact, we are the bridge. We are the bridge that connects continents. We are the bridge that peopled the Americas. And that's pretty cool.
The Anchorage Museum is also in the process of digitizing some of its collections. And while it makes history readily available online, Ringsmith says digital archives are no substitute to experiencing the real thing. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Emily Foreman in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Craig Taylor Equipment Company, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, offering a wide range of equipment rentals from four locations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Soldotna, and Wasilla. CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.